Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
What is all this?
It's a research lab, agricultural engineering. Dean Barry founded Beta Vegetech 5 years ago.
So what exactly do you do?
We're saving the world.
Oh, good for you. I was getting a little worried about the world. Is that a square tomato?
Yes, it is. It's a pet project of Dean's. The square shape means that farmers can pack 35% more tomatoes per carton. It's cheaper, more efficient.
So that means every slice is exactly the same size?
How does it taste?
Who cares? It's a square tomato. You're doing the Lord's work.
Literally.
Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on South Pulaski Road, just across the street from the 53A bus stop and in between Paco's Tacos and Zaka Tacos, it's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast green, gardening, and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in the main.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, our business's people and their love for trees. And by Back to Nature Compost. Life doesn't start with the seed, it starts with the soil. He's the best thing to happen to the environment since the solar-powered hamster wheel. Great. Now he's putting hamsters out of business. Here he is, Mike Novak.
Princess Leia, are you prepared for green world domination?
Yes, Luke.
I am your father.
A square tomato, is that like a tomato that wasn't very popular in high school?
Yeah. That would be a girl who's a geek in high school. A square tomato.
Or like a tomato cigarette.
A tomato cigarette?
Somebody asked me, they're like, I'll trade you a square. And I was like, I got to go back into my archives of, oh, that's right, a square is a cigarette.
Okay, yeah. Well, there's so many different words for that, some of which I'm not going to say on the radio. But it's nice that here we are. By the way, those of you who are listening here need immediately to go to MikeNovak.net, MikeNovak.net. Go to the home page and you will get to see a photograph of Princess Leia with her Star Wars headsets on, and she has them here again today.
They work. I didn't think that they would.
Do they actually work?
They do.
I figured they were just for show myself.
No, yeah, I thought they would, you know, break in half once I put them down or something, or that, you know, the sound would be real tinny. No, it works.
And you can wear them for comfort in the winter as well.
Comfort in the winter
while
I'm hibernating.
You can take them outside. Yeah.
And,
Princess Leia has her Star Wars headsets on. This is, I'm not going to get a pair, by the way, just so you know.
Oh,
yeah, I know. I'm so disappointing.
That was my birthday present for you.
And it's nice to have our fans tweeting us even before we go on the air. You know, give us more work to do before as prep for the show. Thanks, guys. Not Dabbling Zan wrote, and Carrie wrote, she said, hey, just realized I'm in your hood at 26th and Pulaski at the Paws Spay Neuter Clinic. Caught some feral cats last night. Does she go out every night looking for feral cats, do you think?
I wonder, how does one know that it's feral?
You ask for ID.
I'm a feral organ donor. That's listed.
But we were speculating, Leah and I, that, you know, there's so many good cat dishes out there that you can prepare.
Oh, that
I was thinking, soup, soup.
One-ton cat.
A one-ton cat? That would be a big cat.
A one-ton, one-ton cat soup.
Welcome to Sunday. We're a little goofy here. We're slap happy. Leah Petrusiak filling in for Heather Fry once more. As I said last week, it's an old joke.
But Which one?
The one where she does take off more days than Ed Schultz. And I was listening to Ed Schultz this week, and of course, he had people filling in for him. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe he'll get Heather to fill in for him sometime on the show.
That would be good. It keeps things interesting.
Yeah.
Polygamous radio.
I beg your pardon. Great show today. As always, I will give you a preview of next week, however. Assuming, because several weeks ago I was supposed to have former Chicago Department of the Environment head, Suzanne Malik McKenna, on, and then family matters came up and she had to bail on me. But she said, no, the 28th. We're doing it on the 28th. And I'm going to check with her. But as far as I know, we are set for next week. And I may devote the whole show to it. Because what's going on in the city of Chicago in terms of environment is very important right now. Whether it's urban agriculture, which we're going to talk about later in this program during the Sustainable Food Fundamentals segment. Martha Boyd from Angelic Organics Learning Center is going to be on. And you might know that Mayor Rahm Emanuel introduced an ordinance to City Council about urban agriculture. And we're going to talk about what it entails, what's in it, and how it could change things in the city of Chicago for people who grow their own food. Which is a big deal.
Yeah.
I just got done on Thursday with a benefit for the Chicago Recycling Coalition, which was a terrific event.
Yeah, how was it?
I didn't make it.
I didn't write it down.
Leah.
No, but
you broke my heart, you know that.
I am actually upset that I didn't make it. I really wanted to see the film.
It's a cool film. People loved the movie Scrappers, which we showed at the event, about those guys that drive down the alleys in Chicago.
And how the economy has affected
right, and
their
lives, and that's really what it is. It was less a film. It's less a film about the process of picking up scrap and the commodity, although there's a lot of that information in there, and more about the social implications of what it means to be a guy. Well, for instance, when the price of the commodities went down, these guys for a while were making $300 for a ton of scrap. It went down to 60.
Are you serious?
Right, and it would take them a week to pick up a ton, and they'd be paying, so they'd get $60 for that and pay $100 for gas during that week.
That's not sustainable. Right.
And it went into their homes, and it shows you what their lives were like, or are like, because they're still doing it, as far as I know.
Well, you just hope when things get hard that people get turned on to things like growing their own food or recycling.
Well,
and
that's part of the idea. Yeah, hey, folks, if you're listening to me, testing. Here, out there in Radio Land. Hey, let you in on a little secret. Okay, we're all going to hell in a handbag here. So when the economy collapses, and you know, if you listen to people like Tom Hartman, he says, you know, it's got to bottom out before it gets better. Because I don't trust those Nimrods in Congress. I really don't. I think they're we're going to come back. This gang of 12 or that whole super Congress thing, that's going to be a disaster.
I need to get them some of these headsets. Maybe that'll help.
Give them some headsets and make them smile a little bit and be nice. I say get them high is what I do.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe something will
get everybody
will
on the same plane.
That's right. And then
same mindset.
And then send in pizza. Okay. You know. I don't trust them. I don't think anything's going to – I think we're going to end up the same roadblock. It's going to be and you're all thinking it. I know you are. You're all out there. You're all thinking the same thing. We're just going down this road one more time. It's going to get ugly again. I'm getting real close to the point where I say throw all the bums out. Just all of them. Just let's wipe the slate clean. Mm. You know, even the people, except for Bernie Sanders. Everybody else goes. Is the way I look at it.
I think what's depressing to me about the recycling thing is like, wow, okay, money's going down for that. And you just hope that, like with the urban agriculture, I don't know what Rahm has planned, but you just hope in this kind of economy that people are motivated, that there's some kind of economic incentive to recycle, to, you know, do local gardening.
Well,
okay.
Like if they could in Chicago, that's part of the problem. And that's why we had this benefit on Thursday. And I'm glad you brought me back around to Rahm Emanuel, who, I just don't know what he's doing with recycling. recycling. I'd love. Did you see the story the other day where he's sending out having people phone people in Chicago? It's this. He's doing the survey to see how am I doing, folks? First 100 days. How's it going? It reminds me of Ed Koch in New York. Ed used to walk around the city saying how am I doing? Mm. That's what Rahm's doing, and I want them to call me, and I want to say, what's going on with recycling? You know, managed competition, what is that? What do you mean? What's your comprehensive plan? What's the plan that includes not only blue carts but all the high-rises? Because I met people at the benefit for the Chicago Recycling Coalition on Thursday who said, well, I live in a high-rise and blue cart doesn't affect me. I said, yeah. I said, has your building contracted with a waste hauler to pick up recycling? And they say, no, it hasn't. I said, see? Nobody knows what's going on.
You know, at the most basic level, the thing that they could do is like, hey, here's a list of all the places that you could take your recycling. Because if you're very proactive, you'll do that.
Yeah, about the people who aren't proactive, who we want to drag into the system?
I feel like...
And another thing is, at Horner Park, apparently one of the dumpsters was just taken away. Huh? We got several people complaining on the Chicago Recycling Coalition Facebook page who said, hey, they took away our dumpster. This is where we put our recyclables.
Oh,
and
no.
Apparently some people across the street didn't like the look of it because it overflowed because people were actually recycling. and the city, in its infinite wisdom, apparently, instead of putting in a second dumpster, they took away the one that was there. You morons.
Classic.
This is Chicago. Welcome to Chicago. You know, 100 days in, and Mr. Emanuel, as long as you're asking, I want to know, where's recycling in Chicago? Please, give me a call. 773-838-9278. Mr. Emanuel.
Or tweet us.
Tweet us at Mike Now. That's fine. I'm sure he's listening.
I'm sure.
He's always... He just pesters me with emails all week.
Yeah,
I don't know what to
can't
say.
Keep him away. We need a stick.
Second hour also, Project Passenger Pigeon. While we're talking about the idiots... who do bad things in our country. Let's go back 100 years. and 2014 will be the centennial of the last passenger pigeon dying in America. Now, you say, yes, so what? Because a lot of you may not know the story.
Martha.
Martha was her name. And she died in the Cincinnati Zoo on September something of 1914. She was the last of billions. There were billions.
The largest aviation species.
They're
or
saying
something?
At some point they might have accounted from 30% to 40% of all birds in North America.
Wow.
We took them out in a matter of about 40 years, just wiped them out.
Haunted.
That's how good we are. We're good at killing. I always tell people among the things we do best is kill things. We're really good at killing
we're
things.
Awesome.
So we'll be talking to Joel Greenberg and Steve Sullivan. They are with the Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. Joel is an author, a terrific naturalist. I want to make sure I get the name of his book right. I think it's a history of, here we go. Let's find Joel here. A Natural History of the Chicago Region, a fabulous book. A lot of people know about it. And they both work for the Chicago Academy of Sciences and Peggy Notobart Nature Museum, and we're going to talk about Project Passenger Pigeon, which is gearing up for 2014 so we can commemorate how stupid we are in America. And to start, we've got, well, of course, Rick DeMaio. I'm working backward here. Rick DeMaio at 9:30 or thereabouts with the weather. And right now, that gives us an introduction to go to line one and bring in the great, the only Dr. Wally from Pesci's Garden Center up in Des Plaines. How you doing, Wally?
Pretty good, Mike. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a beautiful morning in the neighborhood, isn't it?
It sure is.
Wally and I have been talking recently because I, as you know, and if you follow anything I've been doing on Facebook or on my website or on the show, you know, we put together a community garden in my neighborhood, which... it's just been a remarkable experience, and I hope I'm not boring people when I talk about it, because what it's done, not just horticulturally, but actually more socially in the neighborhood, is a lesson and how you can take control of your neighborhood and do positive things with very little effort. I mean, there was effort involved. You know, Wally, growing things is not the easiest thing in the world, right?
Correct.
But that being said, socially, it's been fabulous. Now, horticulturally, we've been attacked. We're under attack by the dreaded cucumber beetle. Why is the cucumber beetle such a problem, Wally?
Well, the cucumber beetle does a lot of damage to different types of squash and, of course, cucumbers and corn. The problem arises,
and beans. And beans, Wally,
and beans,
I'm finding out. Our pole beans are getting hit hard.
Yeah. What they do is those little guys chew on stuff, and they have a intense amount of bacteria in their system that's in their mouth parts and in their feces. And unfortunately, once the plant gets contaminated with this, it runs rampant through the plant, and it can destroy a cucumber plant in just a couple of days. It causes vascular collapse of all the veins in the plant, and the vines will just shrivel up. The leaves will droop, and whatever fruit is on there is going to be very soft and unusable. Real nasty little guys.
I've been trying to get them to use Listerine mouthwash to get rid of the bacteria.
Use a bidet every now and then.
It does. I beg your pardon. Yeah, that's not working. So you and I have been trying to figure out what to do to attack them. And you sent me some great sites, which I have posted at MikeNovak.net this week's show. Now, you got to understand that you can find a lot out there, and Wally is a smart guy. He knows that mostly you go to the university sites because they usually have the best information. And it's not always, you know, part of dealing with the Internet is knowing which sites to trust. And the university sites are usually a great place to start. And you've got stuff from Cornell and Utah State. And you also talk about not just dealing with the cucumber beetles by controlling them once they're here, but how do you control them ahead of time, which is to plant resistant species of cucumbers. And I guess some of those are coming through the pipeline now.
Yeah, if you look on the internet, you can find a few companies that do offer resistant varieties of cultivars that will take care of, will handle the infestation of a cucumber beetle and not get devastated by the bacteria. There's a little difference between some of the varieties being tolerant and some being totally resistant. There's some good lists, and there's some new upcoming different cultivars that are coming up now that they're breeding them specifically for resistance of this.
To the wilt problem?
Yeah, to the bacterial wilt.
Wilt, because there's also mosaic.
Correct.
Problems.
Mosaic virus.
Mosaic virus. I mean, we're not just talking. See, but that's part of the problem. One is bacterial, the other is viral. They're handled in different ways. I mean, if you talk about, say, something like mosaic virus on your roses, and people get that from time to time, and what it does is it creates these splotches on the leaves, and you can't cure it.
Yeah, that's oftentimes on roses. That often comes from the get-go. How they're grafted and what they're grafted on. The rose may have a mosaic virus for years, and then every year it just gets progressively worse. There's really no coming back to the plant once it has it.
By the way, if anybody's listening and they got some questions, gardening questions right now, this is the time, because Dr. Wally is in the house. 773-838-9278. If you go to Pesci's, people line up to talk to Wally. I know Rahm's going to call any second, and if
he's online too.
He's online too. No, he's not. 773-838-9278 if you want to talk to Wally Schmidtke from Pesci's Garden Center. I'm looking at this one of the sites you sent me, which is the GH Organics, and they usually have pretty good information, don't they, Wally?
Yes, that's a good one.
They're looking. They talk about control methods, and you and I started this week by working on various control methods. Now, you know, in the interest of honesty, I'm going to say, and I'm not going to say who, but somebody recommended I use spinosad, which is the active ingredient in Captain Jack's Dead Bug Brew. Can I have an R, Leah?
R.
That was like a caveman.
I know. That was sad.
R.
There you go. R. But then you did a little more research and found out that that's not particularly effective.
Yeah, it gets moderate reviews.
I'm not saying that it doesn't work for other creatures, but sometimes you got to get specific. You know,
right.
you try to, and given that there's no such thing as a species specific pesticide, you have to try to find something that will cover a range of insects. And then when you're doing that, of course, you have to be aware of the beneficials. Because when you're applying stuff, you don't want to be killing off beneficial insects, too. And it's kind of tricky, isn't it, Wally?
Yeah, it is. There's a fine line, you know, because a material is so-called deemed organic and it's used on your garden, you do run a risk of killing beneficials. So your application time usually would be like in the evenings or early mornings when the pollinators aren't active. So you have to be a little careful no matter what you spray.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's there's such a serious problem right now with lack of honeybees as it is, and you know we have to really try to do all we can to try to keep them going. You know.
Yeah, and one of the things I read because I've been doing some research on this too says probably you said either the morning or evening. One of the sites I read said probably evening is better because the cucumber beetles seem to be more active overnight than they are during the day. So if you hit them in the evening when they're more, as they go into their active phase of the day, you're probably going to be more effective.
Correct.
I've got a call from Pat. Hang on just a second, Pat. Pat's got a question about a dogwood. We'll get to that in a second. But looking at the GH Organic sites, here's some of the things they say for control of cucumber beetles. And they're number one, this is really funny, is use a portable vacuum to get the adults in the early evening. Put them right into a plastic bag, seal it, and dispose of them. Get that. Have you ever used the vacuum cleaner?
I've used vacuum cleaners on Japanese beetles.
Ah.
I take a shop vac and I put hot soapy water in the bottom of it, and I get my long extension cord and drag it out there. And those guys don't really have an escape route once you get that suction on them.
You know what? I got to tell you, I've been doing that in my house for fruit flies.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the vacuum cleaner is right now. It's parked in the kitchen because we've been having a fruit fly infestation, and I'm desperately seeking out the source of it. There's something
desperately seeking
something there, someplace. But in the meantime, I find that a vacuum cleaner really works pretty well in fruit flies because they're not that fast.
Right.
And they're dumb. You can sneak up on them. Honest to goodness, it's you think. I don't think they have any sense of hearing. Because you could sneak up on them with that thing and put it right next to them, and by the time they figure out it's time to fly, it's too late. They get sucked right into that thing.
Right. The cucumber beetle is very quick, too.
Yeah, they are.
If you try to hand grab them, they're going to be real fast.
Oh, wow.
They'll know how to duck under or leave quicker. They're very elusive.
Here are some of the other control methods that GH Organics suggests. Try placing cuttings of the tansy plant as a mulch in between rows in the garden. Spread any type of onion skins on the soil around the planted area. Consider, here's a good one, consider building a bat habitat.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, I'm going to put bats in our community garden. Okay. But bats are predators of a wide range of pest insects, including cucumber beetles. Now, this is interesting. Make a trench 3 inches deep by 3 inches wide, filling it with wood ashes. Moisten it so it won't blow away, and don't let it get on the plants. Ashes can be toxic to plant foliage, but apparently it also keeps away cucumber beetles.
You have to be a little careful when you're working with a lot of wood ashes, though, too. If you do cultivate them back in your into your soil, you're gonna bring the pH up. You know, make it much more alkaline.
And we already have high pH in this area, so
correct.
Which is one of the reasons we don't advise using ashes, except as you know, maybe to get rid of cucumbers. We got a question here. We got tweeted about the varieties you're talking about, the cucumber resistant varieties, and the person wants to know if they're GMOs. What do you know anything about
That is a real good question, Mike, and I have not, like I say, I haven't contacted the companies I got the list from.
Uh-huh. I think it's that's one of the questions you ask out of the gate. Let's see. It says a deep mulch of straw helps by keeping the adults from walking plant to plant. Heavy mulching can deter cucumber beetles from laying eggs in the ground near plant stems, and may hinder feeding by larvae migrating to fruits. This cultural control method, however, does not protect the leaves against attack from adults. Injury to fruit by tunneling of larvae is dependent on very moist soil as fruits ripen. Limiting irrigation at this time can minimize damage. That's kind of interesting. Plant white varieties of radishes or rat-tail radishes with your cucumber plants to repel the beetle. You told me about that.
Yeah, there's, in fact, on their site, they do mention a few other repellent plants like broccoli, calendula, catnip, goldenrod, nasturtiums, radishes, rue, and tansy. You know, it certainly, you know, isn't that difficult to do if you're going to plant out your garden and you do have a nice big cucumber patch planted to interplant some radish seeds right in there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just let them grow up amongst the cukes.
The other thing they tell you here is cultivate in the fall to expose the eggs, which means they're laying their eggs in the soil. So if you had them this year, there's a good chance you're going to have them next year.
Yeah, that's usually how it happens.
And then
sloppy gardening techniques too, where
you have
somebody that does clean up their the debris from their plant materials, especially if it has been infected. And just leave everything laying on the top of the garden without cleaning it up real thoroughly at the end of the year.
Yeah,
then makes them harbor over.
Too. Well, that's you don't necessarily be a neatness freak, but you got to clean up the debris, you know, and maybe plant in the cover crop. And I don't know.
I've always been a big fan of cultivating the garden before a hard freeze too, and I don't mean necessarily rototill it, just kind of turn it over. And get that soil mixed up towards the surface, and then if you get the nice freeze coming and there's some insect egg casings, they're going to get exposed and frozen. So
that's a great idea. Okay, let's. One other thing they say here, and I have to beg to differ. Plant any type of beans with cucumber. Well, my beans are being hit.
Well, they're trying to produce a trap crop. You're going to sacrifice something for something else.
I'm not sacrificing anything.
Those things, the way they are, they'll take everything.
Yeah, they are. All right, let's go to line one and talk to Pat. Hi, Pat. You're on the Mike Novak Show.
Hi. I have a question about, I have had no luck for years now growing dogwood. Years ago, we had some beautiful dogwood plants in the back of the house, and we had to excavate to reseal the whole house, and I lost these dogwood. They were big and beautiful and everything. And I just, something keeps, I'm assuming it's an insect, a disease. I don't know. They get little white specks on the stems and the leaves brown up. And is there something that is, bad about dogwood that they can constantly catch some type of disease?
Well, the thing is, Pat, I'll ask you a couple of questions. Did you hear that, by the way, Walt?
Yeah, yes, I did.
Okay. I would ask you, where do you live, first of all?
In Indiana.
In Indiana. And what kind of soil would you say you have? Is it well-draining, or is it clay, or what?
It's more clay.
Okay. What kind of dogwoods have you been trying to plant? Because there's many kinds of dogwood.
Well, it's the variegated leaf one.
The variegated leaf dogwood. Okay, well, that gives us a starting point. Wally, what's...
For starters, dogwoods really like acidic, well-drained soil, sandy, acidic soil. So
okay.
if you're going to do anything as far as planting those in the future, you're going to really have to amend your soil. They won't thrive well in a high pH, high pH soil. Anything that's clay or dense. Oftentimes, people plant them and they'll amend the soil that's just in the planting hole, and they're not thinking about the transition period where the plant has to put its roots into the surrounding area. What you're essentially doing is, if it's heavy clay down there, you're actually planting putting your tree or your shrub into like almost like a bowl of water, because that deadpan clay at the bottom is not going to drain out, okay. And eventually the roots are just going to encircle themselves, or if anything else, they could flood out and rot. So, you know, you need to really loosen up that soil. You'll probably have to correct it with, get the pH a little bit lower with like elemental sulfur or something, do a pH test.
Okay.
When you plant with an acidified fertilizer, not just one of these blue water soluble ones that so-called will help the plant, acidify the plant, so to speak. But I'm talking about like a good balanced organic fertilizer, something like a Dr. Earth. And Dr. Earth also makes a acidic planting mix that will really help your soil too when you plant. And, you know, be a little careful on how you plant it. There's a lot of good information on how to plant a tree and shrub correctly, but I think one of the most important things is to leave an elevated base on the bottom of the hole so that those root systems aren't sitting like in that bowl of water type thing.
Yeah.
If you ever stop by our store, I can give you a planting instruction.
Yeah, you should go up to Pesci's. As a matter of fact, here's what I'm going to do, Pat.
Okay.
To encourage you to come up our way, I'm going to give you a $25 gift certificate to Pesci so you can go up there and talk to Wally personally. That'll give you an excuse to head up there. What do you think about that?
Okay.
All right, now, but Wally makes some really good points, and one of it is with planting things, people, I think they, as a rule, think the deeper is better when it comes to trees.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually the opposite. You have to find out where the soil line is in the plant you buy. And if you buy a plant that's bald and burlapped, you know, you can get it in a plastic container if it's really small. If it's a larger one and they've got the burlap around it, and they called it B&B or bald and burlap, you have to find where the soil line is. And sometimes the dirt is above where the tree should be planted. I mean, you might accidentally plant it too deep because, and it's hard for me to explain without showing you a diagram, but I bought a bald and burlap tree, and you're looking for what they call the root flare, where the bottom of the tree starts to flare out a little bit. That's the soil line there. And I found this flare buried in this thing. So if I had thought that the top of that soil was where the tree should be, I would have buried it 6 inches too deep. So you have to figure out where that is. The other thing that I noticed is you said you're trying to plant the variegated. And as a rule, Wally, aren't variegated varieties, don't they tend to be a little more fragile than the standard?
They're a little more fragile, but like with the dogwood, the enemy of that dogwood is actually your clay soil. And the variegated dogwood does get a fungus problem later on in the season, which
fungus?
Can be controlled by fungicide. But the other point to be taken, too, is when you're planting in clay soil, when you dig your hole, you need to score the sides of the hole so the root can transition out. And I also am a great believer in using products that have mycorrhizae in them, meaning a root fungus, which will help and develop a huge root system where the roots have a better chance of going out into that soil and doing a good job for keeping the plant healthy.
So, see, this is why you have to go up and see Wally, Pat, so you can get all this great information. So you hang on. I'm going to put you on hold. Talk to Leah. She will get your information. We'll send you that gift certificate, okay?
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're quite welcome. Let's make sure I've got that. Yep, I got her on hold. Good. So getting back to our cucumber beetle problem, you and I, you know, I got a couple of products. I did tried the Captain Jack's, and then we realized that that's probably not as effective. So I saw Milo Seamus this week, Dr. Earth himself, at the Independent Garden Center show at Navy Pier. And now we got some of his stuff, which is all natural. I forget the exact name of it. I know I've got a photo of it someplace. Oh, I think it's actually on the homepage. If you go to MikeNovak.net, you can see our friend Libby, who's part of the garden community garden team. And she's got the home and garden spray, and it's like cinnamon, clove, garlic. those kinds of things. So it's pretty benign stuff, but should have an effect on the beetles, right?
Correct, correct. And that garlic extract is a good one, too, for repellent.
Mm-hmm.
It works well. The only thing that you have to be careful with is using that type of spray, anything with plant oils when there's high temperatures. When you hit in the 90s or something like that, you really don't want to spray anything.
Well, we haven't had to worry about that in several weeks.
It's been nice, pleasant, finally.
Yeah. Well, let me, before I let you go, what else are you seeing out there? What kind of problems have popped up recently? I know you told me that one woman brought in a bag full of cucumber beetles.
Well, I tell you what, my next door neighbor, as an example, had some beautiful oriental cucumbers growing, those real long, skinny ones.
Yeah.
And beautiful, just absolutely excellent plants and very hardy, prolific, and we were all enjoying cucumbers, and then the beetle got them. And within 3 or 4 days afterwards, every vine was dead.
Oh, my goodness.
And so now they're working their way over to my other neighbor, who's from China, and she grows Chinese squash, and they're really working her plants over, too.
So have you gone over there and said, hey, we should try this, we should try that?
I've actually offered to spray, so, you know, probably the next day or so when I'm off, I'm going to get over there, but... a thing that I definitely am going to use next year around any of these plants is the beneficial nematodes in the soil.
That was another one on the GH site that said you could use the beneficial nematodes there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as far as the larvae when they're in the soil, you know, the beneficial nematode supposedly will take care of over 230 subterranean pests, anything that's down in the soil, including Japanese beetle grubs, flea beetle larvae, flea larvae, or, you know, your cucumber beetle larvae. But it's a real sense of timing. There's a lot of integrated pest management timing that has to be used to make sure there's a problem there before you use the nematode.
Yeah, you need to know the life cycle of the insect, and that's something we've talked about before that, you know, when we talked about the squash vine borer. Plant your squash beginning of July. Don't do it at the beginning of June, and you'll miss a lot of that or almost all of that activity.
Right, exactly.
And the other thing I want to emphasize. Now, by the way, you guys have beneficial nematodes at Pesci's?
Yeah, we do. They come. They're kind of packed in a neat little thing. They're called Nema globes, and it's in a little ball. It looks about the size of a little bit bigger than the size of a tennis ball.
Mm-hmm.
It's in biodegradable cardboard, and they come to us shipped with actually a cooler pack, a frozen pack with them. So that keeps them very cool during shipping. They're in styrofoam,
yeah,
like a little miniature cooler.
Yeah.
Because the important thing about them is they have to be kept cool, refrigerated.
Or they
diminish in the container.
I would say, you know, 10 years ago, you couldn't get that stuff. But now, I would think that most good independent garden centers will have beneficial nematodes on sale, like you guys do.
Yeah, and we try to specialize in organics over here too. I'm not particularly proud of the fact that we do sell a lot of chemicals, but people do require them. But I am very proud of the fact that we have organic treatments that can pretty much match just about anything.
Well, you do, and you know, part of that is reality, and we're getting to the point where at some point we won't need to have those synthetic chemicals in the garden center, and I'm hoping, you know, we get to the time where it's just a lot of what you're talking about and how you deal with it. I love the fact that people can walk into Pesci's and you will steer them right. You will give them great information and try to get them to go organic.
Yeah, so, I try to... Try to get everybody on a little more of a green aspect about gardening, and it really is like our Dr. Earth products are so successful. Anybody that's ever used these products, the fertilizers or the soil amendments or the insect or fungus sprays, are very pleased with them. And you know, results are fantastic. They almost sell themselves.
Yeah, well, yeah, even Ron Cowgill from Mighty House on Saturday has become a fan of Dr. Earth.
All right.
So, and he's been using their products, and he raves about them. So stop in, see Wally at Pesci's Garden Center, 170 South River Road, one block north of Rand Road, which is U.S. 12, in Des Plaines, Illinois. Wally, you're there usually, what, Wednesday through Sunday?
Correct.
And you got a question? Just tell them that Mike sent you, and it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. You're a great advertiser, and I really appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon.
Wait, Wally, can I give a shout-out to Wally? My grandfather died a couple years ago in about 4 days, and his name was Wally. And we love him, and Wally's of the world. Unite.
Wally's in
no,
the world.
But, but anyways, thank you. I just want to give a shout-out because the Mass is in honor of him today, and I'm missing it to be on this awesome show, so I just wanted to put that out.
You
but
didn't
anyways.
Tell me that.
Oh, no. Actually, I didn't know about it until I'd already committed, but which was fine, but I just, if my family's listening, I just wanted to say, what's up? I'm there in spirit, and thank you, Dr. Wally, for being on the show.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Okay.
Wow. I got to get a Kleenex out here. Okay. Wally, thanks a lot, buddy. I will talk to you real soon.
Okay, Mike. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Are you as confused by the Chicago weather as I am? If you are, you should probably get a subscription to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, because no matter how stupid the weather is, there will be answers to your Zone 5 gardening questions. For instance, in the current July-August issue, and we're running out, we're going to get into September here, the Q&A section alone deals with issues like how to grow moss in your garden. I'm always amazed that people say, how do I get rid of moss? And I always say, are you kidding? People sell it. You know, you can make money selling moss. It also answers why fungal diseases might be attacking your flocks, what happens when botrytis goes after your peonies. It's ugly. And which ornamental grasses will do well in part shade. If you see an article called Got Lead, well, that was written by me. It's about how I discovered that there's enough lead in my backyard soil to protect Superman from kryptonite. And does he ever say thank you? I don't think so. And since everything is pretty much about me, there's my column on the inside back page. It's like kryptonite to smart people. I'm pretty sure that reading it destroys your brain cells. Pick up a copy of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine on newsstands all over Chicago, but it's a lot easier if you get a subscription. Trust me. Call 888-265-3600, 888-265-3600, or go to chicagolandgardening.com.
Want to make a positive move in the housing market? Replace your siding and windows. You'll improve your home's look and energy efficiency, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling and energy needs. Siding, windows, solar and wind power, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Here's a tip from the care of trees. Here's a checklist of some tree problems that might occur in summer. While most insects are more problematic in the spring, some insects, like Japanese beetles and bagworm, you might have seen some of those, they're more common in the summer. Check your trees for damage that may have occurred due to recent storms. Check mulch rings to see if additional material needs to be added. If the mulch is less than 2 inches thick, grass growing through it may become troublesome. Enlarge mulch rings whenever possible. As I've said before, mulch is God. You don't mess with God. Monitor for insects and diseases. Check your trees and shrubs regularly for any sign of pest activity. Avoid using herbicides beneath trees that warn against such use on the label. This is why I say even with a safe, what we call safe, and I'm using air quotes here, organic product, read and follow label directions, please. The same herbicides that kill dandelions can hurt trees if they're not applied properly. The Care of Trees shares your enthusiasm for the many ways trees enhance the quality of your life. Invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look at your trees. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220, 847-394-4220, the Care of Trees. Their business is people and their love for trees.
You can have a beautiful lawn and be kind to the environment, too. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. A few simple changes in your lawn care practices, like using Milorganite Goof-Proof Organic Fertilizer, can result in a carpet of green safe for your kids and pets. Start by raising the mowing height of your lawn, if you haven't done so already. Taller grass is better able to compete with the weeds. Mow often, removing only one-third of the total height, and leave the clippings on the lawn. Consider using a push or electric mower. It's good for the waistline and the environment. Further improve your lawn's health and greatly reduce weed problems with proper fertilization. Milorganite's organic nitrogen is slow release and won't burn your lawn, even in hot, dry weather. Plus, you don't need to water it in. And the non-staining iron helps maintain the deep green color, even in the heat of summer. So join the professionals and home gardeners who've trusted Milorganite for over 80 years. Use Milorganite for better results naturally. Available where garden supplies are sold.
I want to get to the part where he's passed out on the floor.
We'll stream that next week.
Okay, we'll stream next week. It says on the screen here, Rick Da Weatherman DeMaio. So that's where I'm going to, Rick Da Weatherman DeMaio. How are you, Da Weatherman?
I'm doing better than I was last night at about 5 o'clock, Mike.
Why?
Well, I got a call at about 4:15 from the producer at Channel 2 wanting to know where I was.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, and I was pretty much sitting at the beach at North Avenue watching, well, not so much watching the end of the Air Order show. It ended about 15 minutes earlier, but just kind of exclaiming about how nice it was outside. And all of a sudden I look at my phone, I'm like, why is Channel 2 calling me? And apparently there was a little bit of a mix-up in the schedule. I didn't know I had to be at work. And they said, well, Can you get here in a hurry?
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm like, yeah, but I have no suit there.
And you were in your Speedo.
Yeah. And
the new wave of weather reporting.
It's funny because I worked last Monday and Tuesday, and I had left Tuesday morning, and I stuck my head in the manager's office there, and I said, I'll see you around Thanksgiving. She goes, oh, yeah, sure, we'll see you then. Nothing on the schedule. She didn't really say nothing on the schedule.
Oh, dear.
She just said, yeah, I don't see anything coming up anytime soon. So I got a feeling this was like one of those days that we both agreed that I was going to work probably like back in like March. And we never double checked on it.
You know what? I'm telling you, this is the curse of the freelancer. I had a similar thing happen to me. I'm gonna cop to it, and because this never happens to me. Mm. I had I got up on a Monday, the phone was ringing. It was about 10 a.m. and it was the same kind of thing. Actually, I didn't pick up right away because I didn't recognize the number. So I got about 10:10. I pick it up, and there's a voice on the other end that says, "I hope you're lost. we're waiting for you."
You were going into work for Kathy and Judy.
No, this was this year.
Oh.
This was a garden talk.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right.
It was a garden talk, and yeah. I couldn't believe it that I missed it. I mean, it just, you know, and this is the curse of not having a regular schedule. I do, every day of my life is different.
Right,
there's no 9 a.m. I'm at work and 5 p.m. I go home or 7 p.m., whatever, you know. But every single day is different. And so I have to really pay attention or I'm going to miss something. And I did. And well, I was horrified. I was just horrified.
You feel, and you know what? I'm really good at keeping track. So, And I actually looked back at emails, and I didn't see anything. So I got a feeling it was pretty much 50% my fault and 50% the station's fault. But so I got to finish telling the story. So the producer's like, well, the news is on at 5. Where are you right now? I said, well, I'm in Old Town because I was just walking to my car at that point with my son.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, well, can you get in here? I'm like, well, yeah, but I have no suit. My hair is a mess because it was raining earlier. And I had 3-day growth beard.
Oh, no.
So I'm thinking, okay, how am I going to make this work? Because the funny thing about it is, as a freelancer, I usually keep a suit and tie and shirt at the station. Sometimes they call me in at the last minute to work some severe weather support for Steve Baskerville. And I brought the suit home on Tuesday because I wasn't supposed to be back until Thanksgiving.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, this was so funny. So they go, well, we'll see if we can get someone's shirt and tie that'll fit you, and we'll shoot you from the waist up. And I'm like, oh, come on, this isn't going to work. So I'm a 16-and-a-half collar. I'm on my way in. They call me like a third time. They go, we got Dave Savini, who's one of the investigative reporters with Pam Zekman. They got Dave Savini's shirt out of the closet. It was a 17-and-a-half collar. It was a white shirt with a powder blue tie. I had no suit to cover up. You know, otherwise, you know, it looks really bright. And they go, we'll shoot you from the waist up.
Is this on YouTube somewhere?
No. It gets better. So I roll into the station, you know, parking garage at about 4:30, and I'm thinking, you know, I could put a show together in 20 minutes. I'm pretty good at that at this point in my life. So I send my son. I go, Julian, here's $10. Run across the street to Walgreens there on Washington and get me a small can of shaving cream and a Bic razor. He did his job. He came back. So I went into the bathroom, shaved, boom, 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 boom. They bring the shirt down. I put the shirt on. I go to button the cuffs. They're French cuffs. And I have no cufflinks. I'm like, oh, my God, what am I going to do?
These TV guys are too rich. Who has French cuffs, right?
It was hilarious. So I borrowed the sportscaster, Zach Zaidman, who was filling in for Megan. I borrowed his cuffs. I had Dave Savini's shirt on. And on top of that, I had to tuck my shirt into my shorts, which were khaki shorts, and I'm wearing sandals at the chroma key. And I had to get set up just right so they can shoot me just from the waist up. And as soon as I come on to do the weather, all of a sudden I see, like, below the little bar there, it says my name. You can actually see the top of my shorts.
No!
And I'm like, as soon as I see that, I made sure I stepped a little bit closer and covered up a little bit of Iowa and central Illinois just to make sure that people, like, wondered, why the heck is Rick standing there with just, like, a shirt and a blue tie on? But you know what? I
pulled
it off.
Weatherman.
I shaved. I got the makeup on. I got the graphics done. I got the shirt tucked in. So I had Zach Zaidman's cufflinks on and Dave Savini's shirt. And you know what? It went as well as it possibly could go. So,
oh, my God. You know, now, what would if it had been me, and we need to get to the forecast real quick. If it had been me shaving real quick, what would have happened? I would start to button the shirt, and I would have noticed drops of blood. I'd be bleeding like a stuck pig.
Well, that's what I was worried about, because it was Bic razors and not the sharpest. And so it was pretty bad. So when I finished it, they went, okay, go home and get your real suit. I ended up going home, getting the suit, and come back, and it did a 10. It was fine. But that was not where my head wanted to be yesterday. So,
I so identify with that. I so identify with that.
Yeah. I think the best part about it was after I got the shirt, I went to button, and I'm like, oh, no. I need cufflinks. I have no cufflinks. So now I have not only a suit there, but I have cufflinks as well. So I'm set for any disaster on the horizon now.
Great.
How about that? Weather-wise, we had this big, band of thunderstorms move through yesterday. It kind of delayed, certain parts of the air and water show. But, all I was thinking about when I was driving past it at about 10 o'clock in the morning because I had to go down to the south side for something was, please, I don't want, like, a big bolt of lightning to come down and injure 50 people. So it worked out well yesterday. We got the best part of the air and water show, which was obviously the Thunderbirds. And it looks like today we'll get, almost all of the air and water show in, because obviously as you look out the window, the skies have cleared, the air mass has dried out. And this has been a very lovely period of about 2 or 3 weeks. Wouldn't you agree, Mike?
Oh, you said 3 weeks ago we wouldn't see a 90 in the next 3 weeks, and
we haven't, and we won't see it for the rest of the month of August.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean,
cool.
Literally.
Right, yeah.
You're cool.
We actually, Mike, over the last 9 days outside of, I should say the last 7 days outside of Friday, we've been at or slightly below normal temperature-wise. We've been slightly above normal precipitation-wise. So, I was walking around downtown yesterday, and I was down in Grand Park last Tuesday, went and saw a movie in the park, and I was walking around the gardens. I think people, and I think you would agree with me on this, people kind of give up on summer once they get to about the third week of August.
Yep.
But to me, isn't this the time of the year when the flowers in the city, they look the best?
Well, it'd be because the annuals have matured. You've got that the trailing potato vine, which is at its best and luscious, and the grasses have the inflorescence, and they look fabulous. So, yeah, I think there, a lot of that is true. And even the annuals like petunias that trail, they're at their luscious.
So, and I know we got to get to the forecast here, but anybody who's listening, if you feel like, you know, you've missed out on summer, you haven't, because the gardens, the community gardens, the city of Chicago gardens, some of the surrounding suburban gardens, they've looked better than I've ever seen in the last 5 or 6 years. All the grass is green, and if you want to head downtown to Chicago and see Grand Park, they've done amazing things, particularly in the front of Buckingham Fountain. That faces Lake Michigan. The flowers there, Mike, they've never looked better. But and the grass is going to enjoy, you know, another couple of days of some nice weather. So we had a little bit of a cooler front pass through. Temperatures today, probably upper 70s, near 80 degrees. I'm looking out over the lake right now. You can already see the boats going from north to south to get their spots to look at the air and water show later on this morning and early this afternoon. Tomorrow, high temperature, right around 80 degrees or so. Good chance of some rain, though, comes in here on Tuesday and Wednesday as well. And then Thursday and Friday cool off. But the big weather story over the next couple of days will be Tropical Storm Irene moving through Hispaniola and north of Cuba. Could become a hurricane and could affect South Florida Tuesday and Wednesday, Mike. So that's going to be the big story from the as far as the tropical storm season goes.
And we're going to continue to see a few more, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting. This is the earliest we've hit the letter I, because it's Irene.
Really? Is that true?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
This is the most tropical storms we've had up until this point, tying the record of 2005 when we had Katrina and Rita and Wilma and all those storms. The good thing about this year, though, even though we've had a lot of tropical storms, none of them have become hurricanes, and they've all been basically out over the open water. So even though we've had a lot of names, it's been a very inactive season as far as any landfalls are concerned. Mike.
Because there is no I in hurricane.
That's a new one. I never heard that before.
Well, actually, there is, but yeah, okay. All right. Don't miss another gig, okay?
No,
do me a favor. But that's a great story. I think I might have to archive that on the website. It's just too funny.
I told them I'll show up twice the next time.
Rick DeMaio, you can go to DeMaioWeather.com. He's always got great information there. You can find it on my homepage, MikeNovak.net. I will talk to you next week, Rick. Thanks for getting the job done eventually.
Okay, take care, Mike.
All right, bye-bye. Second hour, we've got Joel Greenberg and Steve Sullivan, who are going to be in here to talk about Project Passenger Pigeon, how we managed to wipe out billions of birds with one hand tied behind our backs, basically. It really wasn't that difficult. And Martha Boyd from Angelic Organics Learning Center. So stick around for the next hour.
Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, our business's people and their love for trees, and by Back to Nature Compost. Life doesn't start with the seed, it starts with the soil. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
We're joining together here with folks in the studio right now, with and Leah's singing along, of course. Heather does that sometimes too. What she does is, I'll play these songs that you know, especially if it's a 90s or an aught song. She just like has every word down. I mean, I just should turn on her mic and let her go nuts. In the studio, I'm very pleased to have a couple of gentlemen who are doing some really good natural, when you know, nature work on nature and history of nature. And one of them, I noticed, Leah, you were taking the photograph of a tie clasp that I tell you, pull that around to Leah, just, and I'll let her describe it real quickly. Oh, pull the microphone around. Just grab the microphone.
Let's see. Well, it's a turtle, but you said it was a certain kind of turtle.
This is a tie clip of the painted turtle, which is Illinois state reptile.
And you want to know what? It complements perfectly with your tie pattern. Was that, did it come with the tie or is it separate?
Oh, no. This is something that I made in honor of the election of the Illinois state reptile recently.
Oh, you made that?
What, you made your own tie clasp?
Can we get some cufflinks for Rick, maybe?
some turtle cufflinks, yeah. I don't know if you heard that story while you're waiting there. That is Steve Sullivan, who is the curator of urban ecology at the Chicago Academy of Sciences, and it's Peggy Notobart Nature Museum. At the other seat is Joel Greenberg, who has been on the show before, and he's the author of A Natural History of the Chicago Region. He's a research associate at the Chicago Academy of Sciences as well, and he's about to write the first book-length history of the passenger pigeon in over 50 years. Well, why would you write about it? I mean, I can understand why it's been 50 years, because they haven't been around.
Well, there are two extraordinary things about the passenger pigeon that make it worthy of remembering. First, if it wasn't the world's most abundant bird, it certainly was North America's most abundant bird. One thoughtful scholar said that he thought there were between 3 and 5 billion birds. That's with a B. And not only were they so abundant, but they massed in their flights. They massed in their nestings. One nesting in 1871 covered 850 square miles of southern Wisconsin. There were flights of John Audubon in traveling from his home in Henderson, Kentucky, along the Ohio River to Louisville. Saw flights that lasted 3 days that darkened the sky for that period of time. And there are numerous accounts, including over Chicago, where they darkened the sky for hours at a time. So, A, you're dealing with this incredible, what Aldo Leopold called a feathered tempest, this amazing abundant bird that didn't live in remote areas. It flew over the great cities of the Midwest and East, so you didn't have to travel to remote areas. The second element that makes this an amazing story is that, and you alluded to it, is that it was wiped out by human beings in decades. In 1860, there was a flight near Toronto that probably exceeded a billion birds. That's 1860. 40 years later, the last wild birds were shot. And the last of the species, a bird named Martha, died on September 1st, 1914, in the Cincinnati Zoo. What wiped them out primarily was us. There had always been local.
Hey, let's pat sure. ourselves on the back here for a job well done. Hey, guy.
As
okay.
As I was writing the book, I thought if they were only more efficient, I could finish the book sooner. You know, but
how does that happen? How and by the way, that's Joel Greenberg, and you have to. It's just stunning to think about it in nature that you could have a bird population that exceeded the human population of the planet at that time by 3 or 4. When did we first get to a billion on the planet?
I'm not sure, but we're now between 7 and 8 billion,
right,
so
right.
We're now more than the pea pigeons were when they were at their peak.
But this was, you know, and folks may say, well, it's a pigeon. For crying out loud. I mean, we know what pigeons are like, but this is not the same kind of pigeon we're dealing with
Steve,
here. Right,
you?
Steve?
Yeah, that's right. You know, everybody's familiar with the city pigeon, that winged rat that poops on your car, right? Now, this thing is, the city pigeon is a bird that's native to the Mediterranean region. It lives on cliffs, which is why it does so well in cities. These are just artificial cliffs, right? And we have taken this North African sort of Mediterranean region bird, and we've domesticated it, and we turned it into that beautiful fantail pigeon that you see at weddings, the fantailed pigeons that they use, that magicians use, and also what we call the carrier pigeon, that messenger pigeon that we used in World War II to transmit messages around, and even racing pigeons. These are all breeds of the city pigeon, Columba livia. The passenger pigeon, though, is completely different. Unlike the city pigeon that, as we've said, is native to the Mediterranean, the passenger pigeon was native to North America. It was only found here. So imagine something that looks sort of like a mourning dove, but it's as big as a city pigeon, and it flies so fast that one of its nicknames is called the Blue Meteor.
Whoa.
And
it really was a beautiful bird.
Oh, yeah. It had fawn-colored back with sort of pink highlights with a slaty blue belly and these iridescent sort of shining neck, apparently a melodious sort of bell-like call in many of the descriptions. And
the males have red breasts, I mean, which further added to the color of the females, as is often the case, were more subdued. But, yeah, mm-hmm. It's a pretty stunning bird.
Yeah, so the passenger pigeon is a distinct species. It's as different from the city pigeon as a lion is from a cheetah. And the passenger pigeon, Ectopistes migratorius, is what we're talking about, is extinct. There is no living bird and has not been for nearly 100 years now.
How did we do that? How is it even possible to eliminate 3 to 5 billion birds in a matter of four decades?
Well, the first account of white people killing them was in 1628, when Champlain stopped near Maine. So they were killed from the beginning. There were huge numbers. They were killed for food. They were killed because they ate crops.
Did they taste particularly better than another pigeon? Yeah.
Well, what they were abundant and cheap. Mm-hmm. They were the most common terrestrial protein. And so really the key to understanding their extinction, so they were killed from the beginning, and there were local markets. But it wasn't until the expansion of the railroads, when their tentacles reached across the country so that you could get birds that were killed by the millions in Michigan and Wisconsin could be shipped to Chicago and New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. The rise of the telegraph meant that if a big flock of birds showed up someplace, some remote hamlet in the Missouri Ozarks, with the telegraph, everyone knew about it. There were actually people who did nothing but pursue the birds. There were anywhere from 500 to 2,000 people who did that full-time for a living. They would chase the birds. They would net them. They would shoot them. There were times where we tried to asphyxiate them in their nesting. They burned sulfur. There's an account of a flock flying over a British garrison on the north end of Lake Erie where they put grape shot in a cannon and fired into these flocks. And it was really because they became a commodity, a national commodity. They were used to help feed the burgeoning cities of the East, and they were cheap for pennies apiece. There were places and times when they were so abundant they were worth nothing, and people threw them out. And that was part of, I mean, that was the major reason. I mean, there are other, the other key is that once then the population was reduced to some level, it appears, and we'll never know the full story, but this was a bird that apparently needed huge numbers in which to really do well. And so once the numbers were down a certain amount, breeding was more difficult. I mean, there were other issues that came into it.
I've been reading about this, and I think it's in the there's a trailer for the film that's being put together about this, and I've got it on the homepage. My homepage, MikeNovak.net, and you should take a look at it to get a sense of the scope of this. But, all right, there's two things that I want to call to your attention, because somebody claims, at least in one place, that the population when the white settlers first arrived might not have been as great as it was later, and they're contention is that, well, the Native Americans were displaced and they had used the bird and fed on it. But my feeling is, if you think about Native Americans and their impact on our natural areas, I'd say that's bunk. But
you're exactly right. That was a theory proposed by a guy named Newman, and unfortunately was included in a popular book called 1491. What Newman apparently did was look for archaeological sites where there weren't any. I mean, he ignored those where there were. Mm-hmm. He ignored the accounts, the very first accounts talking about how Cartier was the first European to see them in huge numbers. And so there's been subsequent research by Jackson at University of Southern Mississippi, who's an archaeologist, and others. So that's a canard that has received a lot of attention because, unfortunately, it was included in a book.
So all you got to do is write it down, and it must be true, huh?
And, oh, man, the Internet is people are still making up things about them. I mean, there's a story on the Internet about a big flock in 1896 of 250,000, and all but 5,000 were killed. I mean, that was, you know, way after there were only a handful of birds then. So there still are people making up stuff about something that's been dead for 100 years.
And that's part of the reason that we want to talk about the passenger pigeon and why we think, even though it's been extinct for 100 years, it's such an important story. Because take, for example, cod. You know, everybody loves fish and chips. Well, we don't eat fish and chips made out of cod anymore because we have caused the sort of functional, the economic extinction of this species. Whereas back at the time that the passenger pigeon was plentiful, you could literally, in some cases, walk across the ocean on the back of cod in a bay. You know, today a big cod is 3 pounds. Back then they were 20 pounds or more. Mm. This issue that impacts passenger pigeons continues to impact things today. And we like to make excuses for, oh, well, you know, humans weren't really important, the cause of this, or, you know, there are other issues. But really, we are the most impactful species on the planet.
I think any right-thinking person knows that and is terrified by it. I mean, I am. I just think it's horrible. To think 100 years down the road, we might not have learned the lesson, and I know we haven't learned the lesson. What other, by the way, that you just heard from Steve Sullivan, who's from the Chicago Academy of Sciences, and Joel Greenberg is also in the studio, and we're talking about the passenger pigeon. What other species are that close? There's probably a huge list.
Oh, there is a huge list. We can look at this list in two ways. We can talk about things that are close to extinction. The California condor and the black-footed ferret are high on that list, as is right here in our own backyard, the whooping crane. But on the other side of that list are things like the sandhill crane. While the whooping crane, there are only a handful, and they famously are guided on their migration by ultralight aircraft so that we can help them reestablish their...
And it makes us feel good when we see human beings helping out these unfortunate birds that we killed.
Right.
To begin with,
yeah.
But on the other hand, you have the sandhill crane, which is a relative of the whooping crane. And if you go outside many times during the year, especially during migration here in Illinois, if you're outside and you listen, you hear that trumpeting call and you look up several thousand feet, you'll see flocks of sandhill crane flying overhead again.
I've been to Indiana.
You've been to Jasper Pulaski?
Yeah, and I love it. But they call it Pulaski, I believe.
That could be.
Yeah.
But even here in the city, every person that is listening today has the opportunity to hear sandhill cranes flying over their house. Formerly, they could have heard whooping cranes and passenger pigeons, too.
This project passenger pigeon, and maybe is jumping ahead a little bit. But
go ahead. But I've got other questions about project passenger pigeon.
So basically, you know, I've wanted to write a book about this bird for a long time, and people said, what can you say that this book that was written 50 years ago didn't say? To which I reply, people are still writing about Lincoln, not to mention religious figures that have been dead for 2,000 years. Well, with this anniversary, with the centenary coming up, it seemed like, you know, this would be a unique teaching moment. So several people, there was a guy in D.C. who independently came up with the same idea, and I talked to Steve and folks at Notabart, and they were really excited about it. So we've created Project Passenger Pigeon. We have over 40 organizations. The goal of this project is twofold. First of all, it's to tell the story of the bird, as we've just done. Secondly, and this is what we Steve in sort of alluded to, it's a history story, but not just a history story, because the second part is to use the story of the pigeon as a portal into consideration of current issues of biodiversity loss, relationships with the world, and trying to live in a more sustainable way. So there's those components. And I think that, a lot of conservation messages don't go beyond the proverbial choir. And I think that for several reasons, in part because the sheer power of the story, and there's amazing characters in the story, human characters that were involved. I think this is an opportunity to reach out to a broader audience.
Give me an idea of the human characters involved in this.
Okay, let me tell you about Etta Wilson. Etta Wilson's father was an Ottawa chief. Her mother was the daughter of a missionary. They lived on the Keweenaw Peninsula of Michigan, and when the birds migrated by, her father killed thousands of the pigeons. He shot them. They used it to augment the family income. As a little girl, she collected the birds for her dad and her mom, and they sold them. That festered. She thought about it. So as an adult, I mean, she became a very talented writer. She edited the first woman's page of the Detroit News newspaper. But then she moved to Indianapolis, worked for the National Audubon Society, and devoted her life to bird conservation. She wrote two wonderful memoirs of the pigeons and her as a child that were published in a journal. So, I mean, here's this, you know, it's not just about old white guys. I mean, here's this woman who is fascinating from two different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's others. There's Henry Roney, who became world famous for his boys' choir. He traveled back in the day when that didn't raise eyebrows. He traveled the world with a small group of boys. He was from Chicago. He lived in Chicago. But when he was in Saginaw, he was the first person, he and three others, tried to stop the killing at a big nesting. So, you know, there's those kinds of stories. There's some other ones, too. So there's that. There's the use of arts. I mean, these birds impacted 19th century America. I mean, again, you didn't have to travel to the headwaters of the Yellowstone to see them like you would bison.
Mm-hmm.
If you lived in Columbus, Chicago, Philadelphia, they would fly over and you'd see them like Steve
and
was
dark,
talking about.
And print. Darken the sun
and,
for a
and
while.
And darken the sun. So,
yeah.
And there's music that was written about them, and we can talk about that. That's a another great character.
You didn't bring any in. I could have played some of the music.
This hasn't been played since 1854, but we want to play it.
Are you serious? What kind of music? What are we talking
All
about?
Right, we're talking about
Stephen Foster?
There you go.
John Williams.
Oh, no. I won't play John Williams on this show.
Anthony Philip Heinrich, America's first full-time symphony composer, he lived in a cabin in Kentucky for a year. He was the only American composer who actually knew the wilderness, and he wrote his masterwork, an 8 or 9 movement piece called The Columbiad, or The Migration of the American Passenger Pigeon, played once in Prague in 1854. But there's this music scholar named Neely Bruce at Wesleyan University who has studied Heinrich and says the music is really amazing. It's complicated. At the time that Heinrich wrote, it was too complicated for American musicians to play, so a lot of it was played in Europe. Some of it has been played here.
Yeah, Americans can't handle it.
Yep. But now they can, and so we're working.
Is it like who's the guy did that? The American composer who did the really interesting stuff later.
Aaron
in the
Copland?
No. The name's going to escape me. He did. He would take variations on American themes and twist them and.
Ives. This is very Ivian. That's great that you mentioned Ives, because Neely is an Ives scholar and sees, you know, connection between these composers.
Yeah, because that's when I heard you describing it, I thought, well, that sounds like Charles Ives.
Yes, and there is a connection. I mean, not directly, but the music has, you know, affinity. So we're trying to get a symphony orchestra, multiple ones, to play this. There are some really neat, there's other art elements that we can use. Let me just tell you one art thing, and then I'll stop it. Or do you want to go on? Stop.
No. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead. You're on a roll.
All right. Well, one thing one image that just really excites me is something that I hope can be done. To mark the millennium in the year 2000, the city of Toronto commissioned the trail artists to work with the school children of that city. They did a number of things, including making origami passenger pigeons. And this culminated in the parade of the pigeons. There were hundreds of school kids marching through a park, holding aloft their paper pigeons. I mean, that's the kind of image that if you didn't give one hoot about birds, you might well find that engaging. I mean, here's these kids. And so, you know, there's an example of something that can be done to both, again, tell the story and to make us think about what we're doing today. I mean, that's what you work on, Mike, all the time with, you know, getting people in gardening to be more in sync with the natural world. And so this is a way to get that message out there. And it could be used in any context. I mean, gardening for that matter.
Well, hey. And right now, but that's the other part of my show, is I get people in sync with the natural world. That's also and past Project Passenger Pigeon is exactly what people should be paying attention to, because we have so many species that are at risk. And I want to address that in a second, but we've got a phone call here that I want to take, and it's from Santo, bus driver Santo. How you doing, Santo?
Life is good.
Glad to hear it. What is your comment or question?
I listen to you guys all the time. Remember last week I had that thing about the scrappers. You told me to listen to Tom Hartman. Well, Tom Hartman has something I was going to talk to you about earlier, but now we're on the passenger pigeon. Listen, I went up to Wisconsin many years, and the Sandhill Cranes, I used to watch them. I could tell everybody, you know, I'm a bricklayer looking at a scaffold. Hey, man, look at the sandhills are going by. You could tell when it's fall. You could tell when it's spring. Thousands and thousands of sandhills going out there. You get up into Wisconsin, they're all over up there, you know, the big wildlife areas up there. But when you get to start talking to the farmers up there, they all got a bullet for one of them. Not maybe all of them, I shouldn't say that, but a lot of people got a bullet for them. A lot of people got a bullet for any kind of animal that goes on their property, anything that they think is a pest, they think there's too much of. I mean, it's not, you know, the passenger pigeon, maybe they were crapping on everybody as they were flying by and people had a problem with that.
Well, you know, actually, I thought about that as you were describing these flocks that would go for days and darken the sun. I'm thinking, how much poop was raining down at that time?
Audubon said it was like snow.
Really?
So, you got to remember, even guys nowadays, there's a few pigeons flying around, or when the starlings are going out and they're crapping on their cars, or they're doing, I mean, everybody, most people look at it like, instead of in awe and wow, look at nature, they're looking at it as everything as being an inconvenience. We're just so greedy lately and so into, you know, if we can't have it our way, we don't want it, you know. So.
That perfectly put, Santo, which is true. If we can't have it our way, if our little pathetic lives aren't perfect, and we don't have, you know, if we can't exist without having a little bird poop fall on our shoulder, then we're going to kill it out. We're going to wipe it out.
We're screaming about the parking. We're screaming about this. We're screaming about that.
Yep.
It's like, it's for some reason in this country, we've just got it too good. And we're still not satisfied.
You know, Santo, you bring up some really cool points.
I got to go.
All right.
He's got to pay his migrating.
That's right.
Thanks for calling, Santo. Bye-bye.
But I'd like to address some of the points you made because, you know, these days we have a really cool reaction that we won't go into all the science of it, but it's called the Haber-Bosch reaction. And basically that allows us to take...
I know Haber-Bosch.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's the ammonium nitrate. Isn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's what allows us to take nitrogen out of the air and put it into the soil so we can grow crops.
This is how we created synthetic nitrogen that we could put into the soil. Of course, the first use of ammonium nitrate was bombs.
Exactly.
And then we figured out, we can put it in our fields and use it as crops or to fertilizer for our crops as well.
And the reason this is significant is because almost all of the listeners today are alive because of this reaction. This reaction is what allows us to create the food source that has allowed us to create such a surplus of food that we can have all these extra people on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, there were wars, as you've said, ammonium nitrate was used in bombs. There were wars that were fought over usually seabird feces, but also bat and pigeon feces. The other cool thing about, you know, as they're flying overhead and pooping on everything, the farmers' fields that got pooped on the most were the most productive fields.
That doesn't surprise me one bit.
And that's because this was before the Haber-Bosch reaction.
Right. But Santo's point is so well taken that, you know, and you know, we can extend it to gardening. When people say, oh, I got raccoons, I got deer, I got squirrel. Now, part of that is, you know, the deer problem is sort of the opposite of it's related to the passenger pigeon, but it's basically we don't have the will to control deer populations. For first of all, we took away all the predators.
Right.
And then the deer populations explode, and we don't have the guts to cull those populations, and they wreak havoc on society.
What we should keep in mind is deer were extirpated from Illinois and Indiana by 1900. They were shot out of existence. We brought them back, and some of them came on their own. So there would have been no deer if you lived here in 1900.
Isn't that amazing?
And so, you know, we brought them back. We have a landscape that's really well suited for deer. One difference, though, that needs to be made, too, is that, you know, pea pigeons were exterminated in a period before there was any law, before there were any regulations.
So they kind of led to regulations.
And they were one of the key elements. When Lacey, the Lacey Act was the first federal law to regulate birds, he said, and this is a quote, we're too late for the passenger pigeon, but there's a lot of other work to be done. So absolutely right. That's one of the legacies of this slaughter. The bison survived. I mean, they're an icon for something that did come back.
I see. I would have suspected that the bison would have been the ones to perish because they're so large, that the passenger pigeon would sneak away and a few would survive and then reproduce. But as you've pointed out, to reproduce, they needed huge numbers, or they were so spooked by the efforts against them that it just wrecked them all.
That's right. They apparently, during the 1870s, which were the last big nestings, these nestings were, I mean, the birds did adapt over time. I mean, they no longer just sat there placidly while people shot them. They left. And so over that decade, the best theory, I mean, we don't know all this because, you know, it wasn't studied. It was before science. But
science on those birds before, you know, we didn't realize.
Well, I mean, there wasn't
serious field biology.
Yeah, okay.
Right. That's what I meant. I mean, nobody studied these things in a scientific way.
They were pasteurized. Milk, but that's about it.
There you go. So the only, you know, so there were there was a nesting in Wisconsin. It was estimated that there were 136 million birds in southern Wisconsin in 1871. In 1878, in Petoskey, there were probably tens of millions of birds. In 1882, there were maybe a couple million. And then the population. So over that decade, the population just crashed. The only thing I can think of, and some other people have thought this too, it's not an original thought, that they're just evidently was not any reproduction during that decade. And so what you had was millions of birds. There were still millions of birds, but they reached senescence. And they basically just reached the point where these old birds and the population collapsed. I mean, we didn't shoot the, you know, they died out. It wasn't like, you know, people systematically, you know, killed.
But we killed them nonetheless.
We did. Oh, yeah. And my joke is, and it's not a joke, once we wiped out after there were no more passenger pigeons to shoot, we shot mourning doves thinking they were passenger pigeons. I mean, there were people that said, here's a passenger pigeon, and it was a mourning dove. So, but the point is that there were other, you know, these biological, they're called Allele effects. I mean, which means that when a population reaches a certain size, there are other aspects, other synergies that come to play. And that obviously happened, and trying to decipher it will probably never fully. But the collapse in such a brief period of time is amazing.
And you read about how in desperation people said, oh, find us some passenger pigeons. We'll try to breed them. We'll bring them back. And it was too late. It was like decades too late.
What's a Chicago connection? There were three captive flocks in 1900. One was in Milwaukee. Charles Otis Whitman at the University of Chicago bought some of those birds. He had a large pigeon collection, and he studied pigeons. That was the second. The third was in Cincinnati. Well, the Milwaukee birds died out, and Whitman's flock gradually died out. But one of his birds was a female that he transferred to Cincinnati in 1902, and the odds are that was Martha, who was the last species. So Cincinnati had the last ones. And, you know, they did reproduce in captivity, but they reached, again, these were old birds. There were no longer any other birds to add to these, you know, inbred old birds.
So they
just stopped. Whitman says they laid eggs, maybe, but, you know, they didn't hatch. So they just basically lost their vitality.
Yeah. All right. That is Joel Greenberg. Also in the studio is Steve Sullivan. They're both from the Chicago Academy of Sciences. We don't have very much time left. I'm going to have to kick you guys out of here. But the question I have about this, we're talking about Project Passenger Pigeon. You said centenary. Is it centennial? What's the right word? I have no.
Well, centenary has been told that's the
really case. Okay. What do I know?
100 years since the day.
Since the last one died. I'm fond of telling the story, and you probably heard this metaphor before. That in terms of planet Earth, you can liken it to an airplane that's flying across the country, and you start to pull out rivets, all right? And as you pull them out one at a time while the plane's flying, for a long time, nothing bad's going to happen. It's not going to affect anything. And then you pull the one rivet that causes the whole plane to collapse. Now, we pulled off a wing back at the beginning of the last century when the passenger pigeon died. My question is, how close are we to that crucial rivet that just brings ecosystems crashing down? And what was the effect of losing billions of birds? That must have had a huge effect on our ecosystems in North America at the time. Have we been able to measure those effects?
Well, to a great extent, we're dealing with shifting baselines. You know, when I take Boy Scouts out into the woods, they look around and they say, "Wow, look how huge these trees are." Yet these trees are 50 years old. Mm-hmm. Show me a 1,000-year-old tree. That's a big tree.
I've seen 1,000-year-old trees, yeah.
And they are truly impressive.
Yeah.
And so some of these effects we have been able to compensate for through things like, you know, adding fertilizer to the soil, domesticating chickens on an industrial and arguably unethical scale, things like this. So as you say, sometimes we can pull out these rivets and nothing happens. The interesting thing is we're not engineers of this airplane that we're flying on. And so we really don't know which one of these rivets is going to cause a collapse. And we don't know if we've pulled it out, how long after we pull it out that collapse is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Could I just, in the seconds we have left, one of the reasons that, you know, 2014, and maybe hopefully you'll have us back in 2014 to talk
more
about
it. Oh, I'm going to have you back leading up to it. I mean, every time you guys find something new and interesting, I'll drag you back here.
Right.
Because this is too important a story for us to ignore.
And what I'd like to ask the listeners, you know, this is an ongoing project. We have 40 institutions across the country, and most of what's going on is by the institutions themselves. We need support. I mean, we need financial support. If you are affiliated with an arts organization, we would like to see partnerships between science and the arts. We need to tell the story of this and science and these other issues. And a good way to do it, to engage people, is through music, is through the visual arts. So if anybody is involved with such an organization, please get in touch with us. My little pitch.
Our website is passengerpigeon.org. And you can also get us at projectpassengerpigeon@gmail.com.
I've got links here on my site, mikenovak.net. Go to this week's show, and I've got links to Project Passenger Pigeon and to your book, Natural History of the Chicago Region, Joel, and to Project Squirrel.
Right on.
Because, Steve, this is the second time you've been on my program, but I wasn't here the first time you were on my program. Beth Botts brought you on, and I was upset with her because I said, I wanted to do Project Squirrel, and she said, I got it first. So,
well, there's always more we can talk about with squirrels, because just like passenger pigeons, people often take squirrels for granted, just like they did passenger pigeons back in the day. Yet squirrels are really important indicators.
And urban indicators, which is a different thing, right?
Right, absolutely. And so the passenger pigeon story can weave in through our lives, whether it be squirrels or bison or deer. The legacy of the passenger pigeon lives with us.
Do we have a call there? I know you're slowly writing something. Just tell me, Leah.
Dave, cloning. He wants to know if you can clone passengers.
That's a really good point. Dave, what's your question?
I'm just thinking about, you know, that you know, they've talked about trying to clone dinosaurs, and that they don't have the, you know, the room or the space for it. Why don't they, you know, like with some of the DNA from the pigeons that they got in the some of the museums, like, couldn't they not do like Dolly the Sheep and clone a passenger?
And then we would have coming in 2014 Passenger Park.
There you go. It wouldn't be extinct.
Yeah. I think I know the answer. That's a great question. I'm going to let you go, Dave, but we'll answer that right now. Thanks for calling.
Yeah,
so there are a lot of interesting issues used with cloning. It's neat that we are in a position in world history, in humanity's realm of knowledge, that we can even consider something like cloning. The fact of the matter is that somatic cloning, using chunks of skin cells and long dead cells, is something that really does not work yet. For example, one of the guys that invented and made on an industrial scale the techniques that we use for genetics today, He tried to clone the thylacine, the Tasmanian wolf. Mm-hmm. He spent 15 years on it and decided to shut the program down. It just was not going to happen.
Well, and let's...
another thing is nobody's ever cloned a bird because you've got this external egg, right. And there's a whole host of issues with that. So nobody's even cloned a chicken, for which there are economic benefits.
Yeah.
And so doing something like this, if it's possible, it's not something that's likely to happen soon.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And given that you had those birds alive for decades and not reproducing, how is it you're going to get two or three and try to start the thing all mm-hmm. over again? Or even if you cloned, 100 or 300 or 1,000, there might not be a mass big enough for them to reproduce.
That's a good point.
And your caller brings up a good point, too, that where are we going to put these things when they do? And once they start pooping on stuff, how are people going to feel about this? We have a whole ethic.
You know what? I get you. I know where you're going. But, get over it, folks, is my feeling. It's like, if shooting sandhill cranes is not an option.
I totally agree. The other cool juncture of human history that we're at is that we have the opportunity to develop an ethic that allows us to live and cohabitate on this planet with all of the other species here, no matter how similar or different from us they are, no matter whether they look pretty or ugly to us. They also deserve to live here, and we can make that decision as a community.
Those are great words to finish up on. That's Steve Sullivan from the Chicago Academy of Sciences. He's the curator of urban ecology. Joel Greenberg, my buddy, is in the studio, author, and also with the Chicago Academy of Sciences. Gentlemen, thank you so much. We will follow this. I mean, it's now part of the Mike Novak Show. I'm going to follow the passenger pigeon and see where it takes me.
Thank you so
and
much,
I hope
Mike.
I don't get pooped on.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Take care. If you're working on improving your garden soil, I've got one word for you.
Passenger pigeon?
Yeah. I was getting too late. Yeah. Burr. I was going to say burr. Nope, not cold in here. Birds, yeah. Oh, Wilbur. No, it's not cold in here. I'm talking about cotton burrs and back to nature cotton burr compost. Cotton burr compost is a great food source for beneficial soil organisms, those organisms that are making your plants healthy. So cotton burr compost feeds the organisms that feed your plants. Put a thin layer of cotton burr compost around your trees and shrubs. Roses in particular seem to thrive on it. However, any tree or shrub in distress is likely to respond to an application. Here's another thing you're going to like. Cotton burr compost is prized for its ability to break up tight clay soils. It also improves moisture retention and fertility in sandy soils. And unlike wood and wood-based composts, will not tie up nutrients in the soil. Pick up a bag of Back to Nature cotton burr compost at your local independent lawn and garden dealer. You can find Back to Nature products at Bob's Salt and Feed in West Chicago, Wheaton Nursery in Wheaton, Illinois, The Chalet in Wilmette. That's the way they like it. It's The Chalet, but that's a different story. Back to nature. Life doesn't start with the seed. It starts with the soil.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Don't mind us. We're just doing a little PR, little photo op here. Are we? Hey! All right, great. Say passenger pigeon. All right, thanks. Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. Does your tree have dead branches? Does your tree need to be pruned? Are the branches scraping the house? Are the branches overhanging into a neighbor's property? Your tree might need to be pruned, cabled, or braced. As trees grow, they need direction, just like some kids. This may be in the form of pruning, thinning, or shaping to remove deadwood. Pruning can help your tree by reducing damage from a storm, providing clearance from your home, and can be used to train young trees early, so possible structure problems can be avoided in the future. Sometimes a tree has branch problems beyond what pruning can improve. A severe split in a tree's large branch can cause the loss of that branch, which could affect the long-term health of the tree. In these cases, the Care of Trees are fibrous, assess the need for a cable or brace to support the structure of your tree so that your tree remains structurally intact. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard, you're changing your landscaping, or you're moving, invite the certified arborist at The Care of Trees to take a look. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees. Their business is people and their love for trees.
Make this your best gardening season yet. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Invest a bit of time now to ensure a bountiful harvest and beautiful landscape throughout the season. And include Milorganite, eco-friendly all-purpose fertilizer, as part of your formula for success. Use Milorganite organic nitrogen fertilizer in all your planting beds. The low nitrogen, slow release formula makes Milorganite goof proof and good for the environment. So choose Milorganite for better results naturally. Available wherever garden supplies are sold.
Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread. Beans and cornbread.
Sustainable food fundamentals. Growing good food that's good for the earth.
Cornbread said, now that's all right. Meet me on the corner tomorrow night.
I'll be ready. I'll be ready tomorrow night.
Yeah, sustainable food fundamentals means we're going to line one to bring in Martha Boyd from Angelic Organics Learning Center. Good morning, Martha.
Good morning, Mike. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you okay. Why, are you talking through a tin can with a little string attached to
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's come to that. Oh.
Well, I knew you people and you foodies don't have any money, so I know sometimes you're just jury-rigging these things.
It's a good skill to have, but it does have its limitations.
Martha's on the program today to talk about what was kind of big news a few weeks ago. On July 26th, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and I'm still waiting for his phone call. Leah, has he called this morning?
He keeps hanging up. He calls him and then...
Oh, is he harassing us?
Yes.
Now? Is that what he's doing? Okay. He unveiled his program to introduce, well, he wants to introduce and did introduce an ordinance to facilitate urban agriculture in the city of Chicago. I know that a lot of groups and people are looking at this proposed ordinance to see if this is indeed going to move urban ag forward in the city. Now, one thing you've pointed out to me is that there was a similar proposal made by the Daley administration last December. How different is this from what the Daley administration was thinking of?
The basic idea is still the same. Things got real quiet while everyone was waiting to see if something would be pushed through before Daley left or if we were going to be seeing something having to start over from zero when the new administration came in. And basically, this is a revamped version of what was introduced by Mayor Daley last December. So it has some changes and additions from that, but otherwise it's more or less, again, the zoning amendment to kick off all of the permitting and infrastructure and policy by the city around urban ag.
I put some of the there's actually an FAQ that the city put out. I've got the ordinance itself, but unless you're really a policy wonk, you'll read through the ordinance and go, I don't understand how this works, because you know it's basically what they did in this ordinance. Is said, well, we'll change this, but if you don't see this other thing, the other ordinance doesn't apply, but you don't know what the other ordinance is,
and
it's really hard to sit down unless you're familiar with the ordinances in the city of Chicago to know exactly what the effect of this will be. However, that's why I did put their urban agriculture FAQ page, which I thought was pretty helpful.
There are two things, Mike, that I thought were helpful. So there's the really long ordinance, which is not about all things urban ag. I think that's one thing to point out. It's a zoning change. So it's really just looking at defining districts and uses that urban ag, both the larger scale urban farms and community gardens, will all fit under. And like you're saying, then there are all kinds of related ordinances, and everybody starts to wonder, well, does this apply or doesn't it? And if I run into trouble, am I going to be able to, you know, change a fencing restriction or something like that. And those are the kinds of things that we still, you know, still want to see explicit how these things would be resolved. But, okay, so there's the full ordinance, which, like you're saying, unless you really know how to read that stuff, it's pretty confusing. But it's good to just scan and get a sense for how those things work.
Yeah, and I did.
There's a summary. Did you get the summary?
The summary.
It's a two-pager, and it does a really nice job of,
Is that from the city?
It's from the city, and it's Urban Ag Ordinance Summary. So they published that as well to quickly lay out the definitions for community gardens and urban farms, those uses.
I did not get the summary. I have to admit, I put up...
I think it's among, and I need to post these to the AUAChicago.org site, but the city put out for people's use when they hosted a meeting on August 9th, the full ordinance, an ordinance summary, and then the FAQs that you're talking about, which I agree, they hit some of the big questions that folks are going to have.
Yeah, among those big questions, what would the zoning amendment do, which is a pretty standard question, what is it? What does it do? And they write, the proposed zoning amendment will clearly define community garden and urban farm uses, identify where each use is permitted, and establish regulations designed to minimize potential impacts on surrounding property and help maintain the character of Chicago's neighborhoods. And I guess what they're saying, there's two things here. One is they're separating community gardens from commercial ventures, mm-hmm. and the other is they're trying to tell citizens, don't worry, you're not going to suddenly find yourself on a farm on your block, you know, because there's a limit to size, especially that community garden. It's, what, 25,000 square feet, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's not just so the zoning code is saying here are the uses that we can say we recognize by right in the city of Chicago. All of these uses have never been in the zoning code as explicit uses that the city recognizes. So community gardens were not in there before, and nor were urban farms, aquaponics, rooftop operations, and so on. So they've all now gotten into the code once this thing gets, you know, assuming it gets passed. They would all be in the code as uses that the city recognizes. And then the zoning districts that exist, each one of these is designated either yes or no within different zoning districts. So this allows people to say, okay, I'm going to try to do this project. It matches, you know, this use that is now defined in the zoning code. And I know that I can assume that it is permitted. The zoning part of the permit is covered because I see it in the code for the district that I'm going to be in.
So are they approving more zoning for local smaller farms, or what?
It just lays out where they can be by right. After that, you are looking at either changing zoning or going in and saying, here's my project, can we fit it in otherwise?
So that could be helpful. I mean, people can see actually where they, if they had a project, where they
right.
could do it.
And,
okay.
and what are the, according to this, the areas that are restricted? For instance, will they be allowed in residential areas?
Right now, the commercial operations are not. Community gardens are. And that's one of the questions that is on the table, is how there are a variety of public and even commercial services that are allowed in residential areas, and trying to understand why an urban farm couldn't fit under the same kind of rubric right now is a question, because most of the vacant land, not the big tracts like the big brownfields, but a lot of the individual lots or blocks of individual lots are in residentially zoned districts.
Yeah, so it doesn't make sense to restrict it.
The number that's been floated out there a couple times is something like 70,000 vacant lots, which is something over 4,000 acres, is my understanding. But the great, you know, majority of that is currently residential districts. So it could be community gardens. Right now, that 25,000 number for the upper limit on a community garden, they say that you could still have more than one community garden that size on a given block. So it's not limiting the amount of land in residential areas that could be used that way. I think that the specifics of, you know, how you talk in a community about using land that way and who in a community decides whether they want to have that much land devoted to gardens. That's the stuff that hasn't been really made explicit anywhere. And whenever it's not explicit, the question is who's going to end up being able to, you know, sign off on those decisions.
But as you and I have talked about in the past, sometimes that's a good thing and sometimes that's a bad thing.
Exactly.
Sometimes when you have it explicit in an ordinance, you're locked in. Mm-hmm. And there's no flexibility. Sometimes when it's not explicit, you can negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
And as I have been noting with the city of Chicago, sometimes it depends on the day you go in there and who you're talking to, rather than any hard fact, you know, any paper that's and anything that's written down on paper. I'm not coming up with the right word.
I think that flexibility is good, but at the same time, it's been so arbitrary, and it's not good policy to work that way. It may be useful practice to have that flexibility, I guess, at the point, but it's not good policy. Your policy should be very clear and make people feel assured that they're going to get fair treatment. It doesn't matter who they happen to get or who they know, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
You don't want to have different people in a department operating differently.
Doesn't this just free up the opportunity
that was confusing
for people to say, hey, we're just going to do a garden now and we don't have to really talk to anybody about it? And
well, you can't do that with a commercial enterprise.
Right.
But with a community garden, yeah, pretty much. You know, mm-hmm. if it's under 25,000 square feet, according to this, you're not going to run into those same problems. However, there are still certain things that you have to pay attention to. For instance, composting and bringing in food scraps is not allowed. You can compost on site, according to this.
Is not a change. So just to be clear, there are use standards that are in other parts of the code that we do want to double check. You know, if you have a community garden and you have to surround it with street trees, for example, whether it's community garden or an urban farm, right now, up to now, the street tree landscape ordinance has applied. And that sort of defeats the purpose if what you're trying to do is have an open, area for light to come in and take your plants.
Yeah.
So some of that, those use standards are already being changed. They wrote it into the summary, and so you can skim through that. I think that we would still like to see what it really looks like in practice. But then what you're talking about, Mike, the composting is a separate issue. Since the regulations come from the state, we really need to look at addressing changing the composting rules for the city from the state level on down.
Yeah,
figure out the best ways to approach that.
I do realize that. And the point being that there are so many different things. You just mentioned streets and sand, environment, transportation, water, animal care, control, children and family services, in addition to the ones that are being looked at now. And these are all different departments that are going to have an effect on community gardens and commercial gardens, mm-hmm. zoning and planning, economic development, health, buildings. I don't even know what BACP is. What is
that? That's the Business Affairs and Consumer Protection.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, if you start listing out all the departments, plus then the other sort of affiliated agencies that have a lot of land, for example, in our area, you're looking at almost everybody having a role in the food and urban ag, network.
Yeah, it's hard to get away from that.
Needing to have a way to coordinate that really effectively. And I don't think right now we have that. I don't think that there's somebody at the city with enough of a sense of how to coordinate that and an appointed, job description.
Well, that's a really good point you bring up. So how is that going to happen? I know that the Advocates for Urban Agriculture are having a meeting this week to look at this ordinance. It's going to take, I imagine, all those people working together and going to the city and saying, this is what we think works, this doesn't. Is there any indication you have the city will listen?
I think they're listening. I think, they're in a budget crunch, and I think we need to come up with ways to help them think it through so that they have an effective way to coordinate things, even if right now it means not hiring a new staff position as, for example, food system coordinator, although I think that would be a lovely thing to look forward to. I think what's more important is job descriptions that say these responsibilities need to be held in somebody's hands who's got some accountability but also qualifications. Mm-hmm. And then that there's somebody in each of the necessary departments who understands what they should be doing relative to this stuff, and that they know who they're talking to in the other departments. And ideally you'd have somebody in a position to be the liaison and look at all of that and keep track of it. So can cross our fingers, make good suggestions, and see where that goes.
Well, you don't want to hear this, but I'm going to show up at that meeting on Tuesday. But don't worry, I'll just sit in the back of the room and
oh, yeah, with my bell. Always so quiet. You're always so quiet, Mike.
Well, I haven't been, you know, in the day-to-day operations of this and the meetings, so it's going to take me a little while to catch up. But I got my reading cut out for me here.
Well, I wanted to mention one other thing, too, and you brought this up. The way this is described so far, we feel is, you know, it's defining some things, and that's important, but it also focuses on constraining activities and kind of this implication that urban ag might run amok and be have a negative impact. And so we're working on drafting a preamble to remind ourselves and everybody else why this is a good thing.
Yeah,
and,
that makes sense.
Why it's good to have it in the code and have it explicit, but also why urban ag brings many benefits.
And then you and I have talked, I think around the end of September, I want to do a show that's wholly dedicated to urban ag and this, and to also the whole food systems and what kind of stores should be there, the whole Michelle Obama initiative, and we will talk about that further, and I have a feeling you're going to be part of it. That's Martha Boyd with Angelic Organics Learning Center.
Have a great, beautiful Sunday.
You too. I will talk. I'll see you on Tuesday.
Okay, good.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're almost out of here. I got an email about fruit flies, and he said they come from the drain. That was from Dave. Dave, these are fruit flies. Those, you're thinking of drain flies, but that's okay. I'm getting rid of them, slowly but surely. Leah Petrusiak, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
What we say at this point, go green or?
Go home.
See ya.